Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. This channel, Trauma and Social Change, it's absolutely the moment for that, isn't it? I'm Steve Hoskinson. I'm the founder of Organic Intelligence. I've been teaching in this area of trauma, embodiment, and social change for about 25 years. It's an honor, really, for us to be sponsoring this channel where we're going to hear a multiplicity of voice, all unique contributors to our collective understanding of how to move from trauma and support then social change. Our unique voice in organic intelligence has something to do with a koan that I'd like to present to you, which is trauma means unintegrated resource. And that's a koan, and if you'd like and are feeling intrigued about that riddle, then tune in to the post-trauma system development course that we are offering here. The coupon code that'll get you half off on that is ENJOY. Now, enjoy this next presentation, and we'll look forward to another meaningful time as we explore these topics, trauma and social change. Enjoy.
I am so excited to finally be putting this together. We have an amazing team here with us today. I will let all the panelists introduce themselves in more detail, but I would just like to briefly say to you that with us today, we have Lucy Nero, who's in France, Fred Donaldson, who's in Austria, Boniface Betty in Kenya, and Rachel Sparks in the UK. And they have all come together to talk about how art and play can be a channel for social change. So I would like to start by asking you to say a few words about the work, the embodied work that you do. And Rachel, can I start with you, please?
Sure, you can. Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. My work is mostly based around dance. I have a background in classical training and contemporary dance. But in the last sort of 5-6 years, I've been teaching people Latin and ballroom dancing with the focus of gender neutral partnering, with the idea that everybody has the potential to lead or follow, and that we don't really need to be stuck in our gender roles in dancing. And for me, this has brought personally, and also in my teaching and for my students, I'm seeing how much the dynamics of different dances have to offer as well in building our potential and our possibilities beyond what we may feel socially has been kind of stuck upon us. So as a woman, I can be a leader, but I can also learn how to listen through my body too, and listen to what yes and no really is. And for me, this is where social change starts. It starts from within. If I want the world to change, then I need to explore myself first. And that's the kind of ways in which I do that. The other way, the art that I create with my dance partner, Henry, we're called Iron and Sparks, and we create performance pieces that are based on queer identity and sharing the complexities of love and pain and the challenges of relationship through dance and through art, but as two people who are queer and our bodies are, could be seen as non-binary or androgynous. We just by performing together, we kind of create a wave of, you know, not everything is heteronormative, not everything needs to be male, female partnered. And we sort of hope to change the idea that everything has to revolve around those sort of traditions and share the potential for love and in all its forms and all its ways. So there's a kind of the queer perspective there. And for me, that actually permeates all of my work is this kind of queer philosophy that we all have potential to be more than more than what we could get restricted by. We're just all bundles of potential, and that's what I hope to kind of bring and offer people in my work and in the art that I create as well.
Thank you so much. Boniface.
Thank you, Julie, and thank you, Rachel, for an amazing sharing about your work. So I'm based off in Nairobi, Kenya. So my work stems from my own personal experience and my personal story of having been street connected in my childhood up to 9 years old, and theater being used by a Kenyan filmmaker and a drama teacher who approached us while we played on the streets of Nairobi to create a play around the plight of African street kids that was to be showcased in a UNICEF anniversary in New York and later in Berlin. So that's how I found my path of using theater, embodied experience, particularly theater, as a transition from street life to reintegration and back to almost in quotes normal life as a child. And from that time henceforth, I began to tell myself, like, because theater was used to help me to find my own personal connection, I want to use the same as a language for social change, for social justice. And also the fact that theater is an ally to already what exists as a resource, as a cultural resource, that cultural resources that we have in this continent that apart from globalization and other things that have come in recently, has lived with the people for thousands of years as their points of resilience. And this is something that no one looks at when they think about Africa, like we have any local resiliences, we have especially cultural embodied experiences, which are really part of our resources as a people, where we reclaim our agency and where we change our narratives and where we find pathways to like having a language around our identity, negotiating our identity and imagining the future. So from this experience of childhood, then I transitioned through my college where I found education support from the institution that used theater to rescue me. And then eventually I joined university. I joined a group of university students that created theater responses to ethnic conflict that was breaking out during, that has been frequent during the period when Kenya became a multi-party state where we had many parties. We just moved from being, from becoming independent from colonialism, then we got into single party dictatorship kind of a state. And then eventually we had sort of freedom to have many parties. And then now the many multiplicity of parties led into conflict between ethnic groups. So the organization I joined called the Amani People's Theater has been in existence specifically to use different types of theater, forum theater, which includes theater of the oppressed art forms, playback theater, but also mostly going into looking into African mediative theatrical, and because in Africa, it's not easy to separate theater from community. So we started to work with groups that way. I led this project with others, worked with prison children who have issues with the law, because I had my own issues with the law when I was a child and when we were rounded up by police from the streets. And eventually I went to study peace and conflict because I had started to go and work in Somalia, South Sudan, and most of the other African conflicts using theater, especially preventing youth violence, working on violent extremism, working with, and when I went to study for my, I went to study my master's degree in peace and conflict studies in Winnipeg, Canada. I came back and began to continue doing my work, working with South Sudanese artists when I was in school, but also after trying to work on violent prevention because of the state building work. And then later when I came back, I started to work with the Green String Network, which is an organization that brings, intersects peace building, well-being and resilience through a trauma-informed approach, because we know that conflict is not the absence of direct violence, but is a state of social justice. Thank you.
Thank you, Boniface. Lucy, can you tell us a little about the work that you do?
So I started my life pursuing the academic goals that my parents had for me mostly. And then, you know, I had a lot of curiosity, but it felt like that was too narrow a path. And I was really living mostly from here. Even though I had always danced, but it wasn't in the center of my life. So at some point I decided to put dance at the center of my life, and I started practicing more and more and trained in a form of conscious dance called the Five Rhythms. And then once I was trained, I remember looking, you know, at a leaflet of like workshops of self-development. And I was like, okay, so is that my big revolution? I'm just going to be teaching self-development workshops in the West. And that felt too narrow as well for me, even though that's actually a very rich field that is now right at this moment where I spend most of my time. But then I decided to go and see if those movement practices that were born, you know, in the West really had a universality to them. Like, could it apply in places with different culture, different social background, even different abilities? And that was an amazing journey for me where I discovered many things. And the first thing is, you know, you can hope that through embodiment and connection and, you know, belonging, we're always working for more social justice and for social change, because the more embodied we are, the more empathy we can have, the more we can see who we are and notice what our limitations are and keep opening. And then when I started working, I mostly worked in Southeast Asia and mostly with teenagers. And that was kind of by chance, even though I had connections with teenagers because I taught high school. And if you can launch the little PowerPoint, Julie, that images might speak better than words to some of the things that I started noticing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the first thing was that there's a depth and joy to dance that naturally brings people to open up to each other. This was in Kampa in Cambodia, in a mixed workshop where I brought some of my students from the West with a group of deaf young people and some young men with disabilities from polio or from Down syndrome together to see how dance could connect us. So what I found was that the simple joy of dancing is already enabling people to just open to change and to social change. And if you can keep, yeah, so that were two of the, now Dan, who's on the left, is now part of a dance company in England called Stop Gap, which really moves me. It really moved me to see him on a stage. His story is amazing. And this was a really moving moment of him seeing how crucial his wheelchair was in his life and that it became a part of his dance completely as a partner. So for me, there's in those moments, what I can see is that art becomes a bigger umbrella in a way, and that's what we see first instead of seeing disability or limitation. And on the right is a little boy who had cerebral palsy and could hardly control his moves, but had an incredible joy of being with us and dancing in his own way. So the joy of dance just moves across. And if you can keep going to the next one. So this was an exceptional moment of in Burma, of having young monks do a week with me of exploring free movement, which the following year they forbid, unfortunately, because in the traditional tradition of Buddhism, dance is considered, you know, bad for being spiritual because it awakens your energies and your desire. So But in this moment, for me, I, you know, you can see how there's a bridge between expression, release of energy, and then deep connection to source. And these kids were not monks by choice. You know, their parents are too poor to give them education. So this was also a way to just, with dance, bring joy to kind of anyone in any condition. And the next one, yeah, these were young nuns. Same thing, very hard lives, these poor girls. But let's move to the next one. Yeah, so that was one of the main things that I discovered with dance, is that in the field of dance, we can truly connect with each other, you know, without depending on our gender or our whether we're tall or small, or we have any physical disability, or even what we call mental disabilities. I think in the next one, you'll see our Down syndrome participant mm-hmm. who had, I mean, you know, it requires having someone who helps him individually. So if you're going to do that, I strongly recommend. But, you know, he was amazing, amazing dancer. And in this picture, I think you can see how different people are just one in the field and how rare that is in society, in a way.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Lucy. We will continue this conversation in just a moment. I would also like to hear from Fred before I bring back some questions to all of you. If you can unmute yourself. There you go.
I'm on now?
Is it? Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Julie. I think my adventure started when I was 7 years old, although I didn't realize that it was starting. I'm part Native American, and my mother used to teach on the reservation. She would take me with her, but not force me to stay in school. So I often wandered the reservation with elders. And one day an old man said to me, "Fred, there's nothing to be afraid of." And I looked at that guy and thought, well, that old man is crazy. I can think of whole bunches of things to be afraid of. And that's all he said. He didn't say anything else. Well, it was like implanting a porcupine quill inside my brain. And eventually it began to affect me. When I was around 30 years old, I began being with children. And since I had no experience, I'm a PhD and I teach university level people. And I had no experience with kids. I didn't know what to do with them. But I just sat down with them and didn't talk. And I began to find out that they had a behavior that they already knew, and they began to include me in it. And what I found was a pattern. And as a scientist, I was used to looking at patterns, but I didn't expect to find one in children. And the pattern I found seemed to fit all kids. Well, it didn't matter whether I played with special needs kids, gang members, street kids, didn't matter at all. That culture didn't matter. They all did the same thing in the same way, the same pattern of touch. I thought, wow, maybe they're teaching me something that goes beyond being human. Oh, that means you have to play with animals. But what animals am I going to play with? I don't know anything about animals. So I tried exploring all over the world. What animal am I going to play with? And eventually a friend directed me to a wolf reserve. And I started playing with wolves for 10 years and found out the wolves played just like the children. Then I went to dolphins in Australia, and the dolphins played like the wolves. And I moved back to the States and played with elk and black bear and grizzly bear. And then I got the idea, hey, this kind of play is not cultural. This is not an artifact of being a human being. This is a gift from creation that lets us all know a pattern of trust and belonging without language, without anything. All life knows the same pattern. And if I know it, I can communicate love instantly to every being on earth. And so the kids and the animals began to teach me a pattern of incredible mystery and beauty that expresses love through touch and communication, regardless of, and I never read anything about the animals I play with. I don't read about lions. I don't read about autism. I don't read about men and women in prison because I don't play with those categories. I call it original because it is original. It comes from the origin of life, not from me, not from culture, not from being human. It's a life process given to us by creation, or God, or Allah, or Great Spirit, whatever terms we want to use. And since I was 30 years old, I've been living with kids and wild animals in that spirit. Thank you, Julie.
Thank you so much. You have all touched on this, and this is exactly why I've invited the four of you here. It seems that all of your work, you know, this creative, this artistic work that you're doing is connected to the idea that it is something that drives social change or social transformation. And I would like you to say a bit more about that. So in what way to you does art, does play create change? And feel free to jump in if you're willing.
So it's one of the things that I left out in the last part of the PowerPoint, which also connects with the work that Rachel is doing. I find that through play, you can do a lot around leadership. And since I worked in Southeast Asia, where the society is pretty macho, basically men dominate and, you know, women are supposed to be in service to men in all kinds of ways. And I found that especially with teenagers where, you know, change is still easier to let happen because the structures are less fixed. Through playing with, you know, one person in the group leading and the rest of the group following, I could alternate, you know, a guy leading with a girl leading. And that it would teach the boys that they can follow the leadership of a girl in a way that would have been a hell of a lot more difficult to do, you know, if we'd like put this as a very serious education thing. So with the playfulness and the joy of the dance, you can open to change that kind of happens unconsciously, and then we'll leave some imprints.
Yeah,
Bonfay. Yeah, in Africa, we storytelling, like they always say that we eat, our food is we eat stories, and we are very oral society. So, and it's not just by accident or something that is negative, but it's part of our being in the world and how we view the world. And if you can be able to use storytelling in a very constructive way in this part of the world, then because trauma gets people stuck in time, and storytelling creates the time collapse where now people can be able to heal their traumas and also like get unstuck from the time because of story provide the time collapse for transformation to happen. So in the organization I work with, which is mainly, we work as a social movement kind of approach, healing social movement. And our work really, because of using play, we are able to tap into the power of storytelling, which is already a cultural resource in this part of the world. So we are not reinventing the wheel. And at least we are working from a resource, from an asset-based approach, if we use storytelling, because this is something that is already in existence, that a lot of other approaches, especially development approaches, do not really tap into. They say, put away this one. We don't want oral culture. We don't want cultural approach. We want to give you something better. But our approach really is to say, like, you have something to offer to yourself and the world, which is storytelling. And this can only be afforded through play.
I think in the big part of what I do is change the human being's reliance on fear as a motivation for doing things. And to find out in real life, when your life is on the line, love is safer than fear. And love, for most people, love and peace are soft things that don't have any action to them. And what I've learned from kids, and especially animals like lions, wolves, and grizzly bears, is to be very soft and very strong all at the same time. Those aren't different things. And the reality is, I use the same touch patterns with a human infant that I use with a butterfly and an elephant and a whale. It makes no difference at all. When I play in prison, everybody relies on fear to keep their roles, to keep guards and prisoners rely on the same thing. So what I'm actually doing is presenting them an embodied state in which you are no category at all. You have to let go of being a prisoner. You have to let go of being a warden. That's the only place where safety actually lies. But that takes some practice in letting go. And that's one of the big things that children have taught me, that I have to let go of all the categories I live in my normal life if I really want to feel and see a face of God.
I'm nodding at everything everyone's saying. It's speaking to me a lot. And what I hear and what kind of comes through for me as well is about going towards, so going towards what we want more of. So play and art for me is all about creation and moving towards more of what we want and need. On a sort of simple level, by inviting people to come into connection in partnering, in partner dancing, there can be so much fear and lots of fear of failure and fear of being laughed at. Just simply dancing can bring up so much for many people. And I tend to draw people to my classes who are have some other barrier. There are many other barriers other than the kind of social fear of dancing. But, you know, being a queer person and being scared that you're going to be told you can only do one role, or being a person who is has anxiety, anything like that, that just creates another barrier, another reason why it might be harder or might be more challenging to move. But by kind of saying, like, creating safe spaces, like, say, you know, what is a safe space? But by saying, you are okay as you are, and I love you as you are, just offering that, and then inviting people towards each other with choice and with body autonomy as well, learning what's a yes, what's a no. And for me, I feel like I'm working much more on the individual level. Those the changes are ripple effect rather than working with large organizations or trying to shift big groups. It's like offering the little small changes for individuals to see their place in the world and take more space in the world. That tends to be the kind of people that I draw into my work anyway. But it's the towards thing. It's going, moving towards and through and in, rather than what do I want to change and be different from? Like, how can actually we find what's unifying about us, what's human about us, and how do we dance with that and see that we can all embody both and everything? If we think about yin and yang, we can be all of that. We don't have to take sides. And I think we need a little more of that kind of unifying, allowing ourselves to be different, but also know the humanity and know the humanness of us all and connect with each other through that.
Wow. So I'm hearing a lot about the social change being being affected by creating more authenticity, helping people overcome barriers, develop some flexibility in, say, the roles that they may be used to. I love the idea, Boniface, of building on some existing values of a culture in order to kind of create change through that. And of course, a thought that I've heard from all of you is about finding some, some humanity that we all have in common. So with that, I would like to ask you about the role that this art and creativity and play has in your lives personally. What is it for you, not only as a professional?
Certainly one of the things that helped me is to be comfortable with mystery and be able to see beauty every day, everywhere, and be able to handle attacks, not just attacks that are verbal, but attacks that can kill me instantly. I have no choice. I die in the next second. And to be able to give love right at that moment of life and death and find out, my God, that old saying about love conquers all is physically real. Up until facing death, that was a nice thought. And I say, oh yeah, that's cute. But when you're actually facing life and death in the next instant and you have no skills to handle it, you find out that life, that the children and the animals have given me and a range of skills that are far beyond what humans ever imagined. If you've ever seen the movie Matrix, it's imagine Matrix times 10. And you get to the level of skills, not that can be taught by humans. I'm not taught by humans. I'm not taught by culture. I'm taught by a pattern of behavior that goes way beyond what humans can imagine, but it's real. And that saves lives. And whether it's cancer, dealing with cancer in my life, dealing with divorce in my life, dealing with attacks by gang members or wolves, lions, doesn't matter. The attack doesn't matter. Because what happens is the love changes the fear, both in me and then between me and whatever the attack is. That's incredibly powerful and incredibly loving. So I'm here because of their love.
I think personally, art give me the opportunity to connect with myself. And also, as a metaphor, it gives me the aesthetic distance, like the space for reflection and to tap into my human experiences, especially because my lived experience is part of who I am. And being living in the context where I live, going to maybe to another country or being in my home country, there is no language or very rational ways of especially explaining the experiences that I undergo. And also, like, it helps me to clarify my identity, that many times, like, shifting identities where you come in as a professional or you come in as a person who lived in that experience or in my relationships with others, with the organization, or even with the world around me. So the art is even a language for me also, beyond the languages that are spoken in many places that I have been. Like, I connect with people who are artistic in many other contexts, even without using language that can be understood by all people. A good example is when you work with groups from different countries or different cultures or different experiences, and the art gives you the language and the capacity to interact in a more deeper way, at a more deeper level than using words and especially words as metaphors. Yeah.
So I feel like I was hearing Fred speak, I was like, wow, you know, I feel like a baby. Like I have not been under death threat, yeah, for the moment. And however, both the dance and also, you know, writing, poetry, visual art, collage, which are all part of my personal path and what I offer professionally, have really opened me up to the joy of being, just the joy of being and coming into the present moment. And when I was younger, when I was starting on that path, like I had to dance my ass off before I got there. Like, you know, I'd have to like really, you know, give it and like give everything I had. And when I was exhausted, finally I would fall into that place of just being. And the gift of the practice is that now I can set one foot on the dance floor, you know, on a good day, and I'm right there. Like I don't have, and it's a good thing because I'm getting older, so I don't have, you know, as much energy. And I just want to just try to show you what it looks like in the kind of interaction between my professional life and my personal life. Because as I started exploring professionally, it opened up so many things for me personally. I just got to places I would never have imagined that I would get to. And like in this picture, I'm sharing my screen not very skillfully. There we go. So here you can see me on the left with a Mon dancer, a refugee from Burma, on the other side of the Thai border. And like, I got to connect with the wildness of these young men, young women, mostly the young men who were incredibly wild. And I think if I'd met them in a different context, I would have been really scared. And there's something in art and creativity that really creates a bridge. And here I led this group and, you know, I'd brought some pretty expensive crayons. So when they started using it on their faces instead of on the paper, I wasn't entirely happy. And then I realized, you know, that was their tradition, the Mon tradition. They paint their faces, and they just took that tradition and let it go wild. And I had one of the most extraordinary moments of letting things happen. So art and dance has loosened my rigidity, especially the rigidity of the academic world. And so through it, I feel so much more alive. There are many more possibilities for allowing myself just like them to be who I am, you know, to let my pain be seen as they let their pain be seen, to, you know, express my anger at injustice, and to realize that I had become for some of these girls a model of another way to be a woman. So the dance gave me a different way to be a woman in the world, or in a way, as someone else was saying, to just be a human being. So to get below all the, you know, all the structures, all the little boxes, and just get to being human. And the beauty that comes out in art, even when the sources are pain or our anger, that there's some transformative process that happens that I find deeply opening and healing.
Yeah, again, so much agreement. I was just thinking about my own personal experience as well. Like, I really hear a lot of what you're saying, Lucy, is very similar to my experience as well, of dance being like a healing place for me. But also in partnering, I find like in any relationship, other people become a mirror. And so when I'm in contact with another person, they are a mirror into my nervous system even further. And so I've learned a great deal about things I couldn't know about myself until I had some feedback from another person, an inner dance where there was a lot of trust and there was a lot of experience well, it didn't even have to be someone I know very well necessarily, but that you're both there willing to trust each other and be vulnerable with each other. I think vulnerability is there's a lot of it in when we come into art and come into movement. But even like for me, painting, for instance, is a very vulnerable place because it feels just something I can't do. You know, the belief of not being able to do something that is really just fundamental to being human is the expression of self through art, right? But we judge ourselves so harshly. But having I digress easily and quickly. Just having another system, another body to play against, to move with, to have to be listened to be witnessed, and to hear a bit more of my own body through another person's body, and then play, you know, and play the game of leading, play the game of following, and see the potential in that, and what is it like to shift and change and not have to, yeah, be fixed. That whole idea of like letting go of the fixedness, because Latin and ballroom can actually be quite a rigid way of dancing. It's very structured, it's very examined, and you know, you do competitions in it, and it's quite strict. But I've kind of wanted to loosen that up, and my experience of it when I have loosened it up is that it can become a game and a lesson. It teaches me so much when I'm with another person, like the mirror of another human.
Thank you. All right. So yeah, I'm hearing a lot about Rachel, what you said earlier about, you know, working with the individual and then that rippling out into communities. That's exactly the way I put it when I, at the start of the conference, when we talked about the trauma and social change channel, I share that idea very much so. And also you've talked a lot, all of you, about how this kind of healing, the healing of our humanity comes through connection. Yeah, connection with ourselves, connection with other human beings. And so in the context of this whole creativity and play and art, what is something you might suggest to someone who would like to have a bit more creativity, a bit more playfulness in their own lives?
So that's easy for me. Like, if you've never done anything like that, I'd say put a piece of music that, you know, you like. Move to it, you know, for as long as you want, a few pieces of music, get some magazines and do a collage. Collage is a great way because it goes directly to your unconscious if you just let the images come. And also you don't need, as Rachel was saying, to know how to draw or how to paint, because you can use the images and let them combine. And then when you look at it, usually it'll talk to you. So that would be, for me, a way to do it easy at home.
Yeah, I think for me, I will say you can be able, artists so available everywhere. Like, I think each one of us is an artist by nature. It's only that probably we have not unlocked or tapped into our artistic selves and allowed our artistic genius to flourish or to come out, because people sing in the shower and people do all manner of, like, they do all manner of artistic things each and every day. They share humor and all these kind of things. And you realize some of these, we call in the peace building world and social change world, we call using the arts in peace building as the softer approaches to peace building. Because there are more the humanistic approaches to peace building. Like, art is something we can find within ourselves, but I know very well where trauma is involved and where there is a lot of I mean, where there is a lot of issues of fear and violence, especially chronic violence, there is a lot of freezing in the body and freezing in many ways, so that what trauma does, trauma removes the creativity that we have, that we naturally have, and then it makes us to live in survival mode, you know, in flee, flight, and freeze modes, which don't allow for creativity to take place and to be part of the beauty that Fred was talking about. So I believe if we can be able to find pathways and small ways to tap into what we already have, especially working through embodied experiences, to be able to tap into our creative selves, that is the place where we'll find healing, especially in the times of chronic trauma and psychoviolence that we experience today.
I would say that I'd want to give people a hint on keeping the world safer, and that is tilt your head whenever you're in an interaction, especially that's conflict oriented. And I don't mean bend your head over to the side. I mean, just as you've watched the three women on this program today, if you look back at the shape of their heads, they tilt their heads. And why do we do that? If you watch women around the world look at a baby, they're gonna tilt their head. And I've asked all over the world, why do you do that? And nobody knows. I know. It makes the world safer. A tilted head is a sign not of weakness, but of softness. And that's the softness of strength. If anybody listening to this wonders what exactly am I talking about, go look at a photo or a statue of Mary and look how she holds her head. Why in the world is she doing that? And I'm not talking about this in from a point of view of theory. I'm talking about from a point of view of a person who faces conflict all the time. Human conflict, wild animal conflict. And I know that just tilting my head can soften the world around me because it softens me.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'll do that a lot. It's and it's also interesting to as for someone who does that a lot to sometimes straighten up and look at life from that perspective as well. I think the offering the ideas of the choices that we have, the automatic things we do, and then what are they, what could they be as a choice? Something, a tip for accessing creativity. I found that as a person actually that I've always taken myself incredibly seriously, and at one point had a real lack of humor and ability to laugh at myself. I'm working on that. I'm a perfectionist. It's harder, I think, to let go and find creativity. What I actually had to do first to access play was to understand my own boundaries better. So be able to say yes and no much more clearly and really know where joy sat in me and where my sense of this feels safe, this doesn't feel safe. So I actually started doing karate as a way of accessing more fire in order to eventually come to a more playful ability. So it sounds like a roundabout way, but for me, if you're someone that, I don't know, takes themselves too seriously or finds they can't laugh at themselves easily, I found that accessing a sort of inner strength and sense of stability in my body allow me to feel more safe to go into play and a bit more chaos and like free form. It's interesting. That's how I got there myself. And maybe that speaks to you, maybe it doesn't, but you know, take it or leave it. I don't mind.
And people are also asking in the Q&A how we can bring a bit more of that play into our relationships. So So we only have a few minutes left, but if you want to add some insight into that.
I think Rachel would agree with that one, is dance together. that will really put some movement in it.
Make sure you touch with your hand and your heart everybody every day. No excuses.
You can sing a song together with your friends and your people that know you. Sing a song together. Singing is so powerful and transformative.
I think it is like allowing ourselves as adults to do what children do so easily and naturally. They can laugh and play and dance and sing and role play and try and suspend the fear of what all that means, or being, you know, be silly. It's okay. Like, but maybe start small, because it can feel so intimidating as someone who's been intimidated by play before.
I know this is a big topic, but what about now when we're not so much encouraged to touch one another? Is there something you might add to that?
Sure. Everyone knows that you touch with your eyes all the time. I used to do an experiment in Stockholm on the city buses. I'd watch all the adults sitting in their seats, reading newspapers or playing with their electronic things. And a mom would come on with a little baby, and every single adult turned their eyes to that baby as the baby moved down the center of the bus. And I thought, how does that baby do it? So I'm gonna start doing that. So what I would do is stand on the subway in Stockholm and start waving to people that I didn't know. And they started waving back. You can use your eyes to connect. We do it all the time when we date. Now we forget. And you can broadcast your presence. When the virus first started here in Austria, I would stand outside the grocery store and I would say to myself, okay, when I go in there, I'm gonna do the same thing that I do in prison. And what that is take my presence and fill the entire grocery store with love. Every single spot is filled with love. Everybody can do that all the time, everywhere. It takes no training, no anything. You just do it. You don't have to touch. We touch already with our eyes and our presence. Use them.
Thank you so much, Fred.
And also another thing that you can use is your imagination, which is a big part of creativity and play. And you know, neuroscience is now showing how powerful imagination is. So if you imagine touching each other, it actually brings information to your brain as if you were touching. So really just feel free to, you know, use your imagination together and bring strong connection.
Thank you so much. I would like to wrap this up. I will come back to all of you to ask you about the top tip for being more embodied that you would give to all of us. I know you've already given many suggestions today for creativity and everything. I'd like to share some information with those of you tuning in. First of all, you are very welcome to join the Facebook group if you haven't yet. And if you go and join the Trauma and Social Change group, you can see the live streams from this channel as well. Also, at the end of this session, after the session ends, you're welcome to join what we call a coffee break room. These are Zoom sessions that are open between presenter sessions. And this is an opportunity for you to connect with other participants. Because I know sometimes, you know, we've been interacting here, but if you've been sitting there and just listening to this for a whole hour, it might be nice to go and actually see someone and talk to someone, be seen. And so that's the place to do that, in the coffee break rooms. Also, all recordings, including the recording of this session, are available on the Embodiment portal for 48 hours after they stream. They're available free of charge. However, you know that there are 10 different channels happening at the same time. There's so much richness, so much wisdom being shared by teachers from around the world. So if you would like the opportunity to own that whole library, to be able to digest all of this in your own time, to have access to audio-only downloads and summaries of every session, then you're welcome to upgrade and either purchase access to one channel or to the whole conference. And that really means a lot to us because it helps us make this conference happen. So thank you. And I would like to briefly come back to our wonderful panelists and ask you my question. What is one tip that you would like to leave your viewers with today? In a sentence.
I think because of COVID and how it's made everyone afraid to breathe, you know, either to breathe out and contaminate someone or breathe in and be contaminated. I think right now a really good tip for being more embodied is feel your feet on the ground, or, you know, feel some part of your body connected to ground, and just really allow yourself to deeply breathe, like, you know, connect back to breath as life, as life source, and enjoying that.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Knowing it is not enough. Be what you want. Be what you want to see in the world, and learn a way to live that. Is my tip.
Thank you. And Fred.
It's how to use your hands. Don't grab the world, embrace the world, and let the world embrace you.
Learn to focus on the beauty that is around us, but also play theater games, sing songs, dance, and let your creative self find full flow out of your soul.
Wow. Thank you so much. I feel a lot of gratitude for everything that you have shared today. I'm going to post a link to this session, so where you can find links to all of the panelists today. So you can find their websites, how to learn more about the work that they do. Please do check them out. As you have seen in the past hour, these are amazing human beings. Thank you so much for joining us today. Please do take care of yourselves, both viewers and panelists. Make sure that you take care of yourselves, especially when we have so much goodness to take in. Thank you so much, and I look forward to seeing you in our next sessions.
Thank you, Julie.
Thank you, Julie.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thanks, Judy. Thanks, panelists. Lovely to meet you all.